Hello, this is me talking. That's right. This is episode 162 of Living Room Music by N8K99. Last week I put out an episode. Amazing, right? It had been a little while since I had done so. So it felt like a victory, putting out a episode of music, such as it is. I mean, most of my stuff is, hey, what kind of sounds can I make? What kind of stuff can I do? I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, just experiments in sound. It's nice. It's fun, it's releasing, it's engaging. And not that I can't play music. I'm pretty sure I can. I have since I was 3. Been playing the piano or trumpet or the guitar, which I taught myself. And as I was telling Tommy Berlin earlier this week, I feel like I'm faking it when I have a guitar in my hands. I feel like I'm not really a guitar player, so I have to prove myself. I have to be better than that other person right next to me playing guitar. I can't just play guitar and play guitar. But when I sit down in the band room, because I'm in a band with Tommy Berlin, it's called Radio Poets. We have one song on Spotify. You should listen to it. It's called Alice in Neverland. It's great. I play trumpet on it. Anyway, I can sit in the band room behind the organ and the keyboard, and I can be exhausted. I can be worn out. I can be tired. I can be not thinking. And I cannot remember the songs or the chord progressions that are written in the chart. Not that we have any charts, but I'll call it a chart just because. And I can play along. I can play along and I sound like I'm part of the song, until I get to the point where I go, oh, that's what song we're playing. And I mean, there's usually a moment, really quickly, like the first 30 seconds, that I go, oh, right, that's the song I'm playing. And even with half my brain, I was telling him, I can play along. I can sound like a keyboard player in a rock and roll band. I don't know if that's a hard or easy thing. I don't know. There's some Dunning-Kruger effect there for you. I don't know how hard it is to do what it is that I do when I'm sitting there playing along with Pete and Todd and Tommy in the Radio Poets. I don't know. I really don't. I don't know how hard it is to do what it is when I sit down in the studio here and just make something up. I don't. I just do it. I'm like, hey, here's a really interesting sound that I've come across. Maybe it's a sample that I'm getting from Splice. Or maybe it's coming out of the sample pack that's in Logic Pro. I don't know. You know, whatever. Or maybe there's an interesting chord progression that I want to try out. I mean, I don't know if you heard it or not, because this mic seems to be only One Direction, but the piano, I just played A minor, G, A minor, E minor, which, I mean, not a major world-shaking chord progression, but sometimes that's the kind of thing I want to hit. It's like a mood, a vibe, and I do it, and I don't know how hard it is. I don't. I really don't. I just do it. And if I don't think about it, it sounds pretty good, at least to my ears. Sometimes that's all that matters. It sounds good to my ears. So anyway, that's my vibe check for this week. I'm gonna try to transition this podcast into something that's more, talking, even though I absolutely hate the sound of my own voice. I'm gonna just try talking, cause whatever, you know. So that's my vibe check, I guess. All right, here's the segue. Dun da da da. I'm hugely fascinated with technology. In all sorts of directions, in the shape of musical direction, like making electronic music, experimental electronic music, making electric music with like guitars, and like, you know, sometimes the guitar player in a rock and roll band is more of an electronics player than he is actually playing guitar, because a lot of the, like, I saw a really interesting clip of metal without distortion. And it was really, I mean, it can be kind of goofy sounding if you set your instruments up properly or improperly, depending on your perspective. A guitar player is playing electronics even more than they're actually playing the guitar. Of course, they got to know their scales and their little trill-ons and tap-ons and sweeps and all of that stuff in order to be the fancy sounding guitar player that they are, but their guitar sound is not their guitar sound if you give them an acoustic. It's different. So I'm highly fascinated by technology and music. Arguably goes back to 60,000 years ago when someone took a bone, hollowed it out, carved a couple of holes in it, and made a flute. That's technology. Technology and music go hand in hand with, like, the invention of writing becoming systems in order to record long, complicated thought patterns, which are melodies and harmony movements that allowed 70, 100 musicians all simultaneously to play the same complicated piece, and we get the romance and the baroque and the classical eras of music that way. Technology gives us that. A musical instrument is technology. A Stradivarius violin is the peak of technology from 500 years ago. So I'm keenly interested in technology, and my segue, which has lasted a full 4 minutes, is that I'm interested in AI, what we're calling AI. Algorithmic generation is probably more realistic, but that's difficult to throw out over your tongue, and way too many people already blaming the algorithm on things as it is, so I'm not gonna muddy the waters anymore. I'm talking about AI. What you colloquially understand as AI is ChatGPT or Claude or whatever, your little Grok. See, Kyle, AI, it's a tool. But it's a cognitive space, because you don't just screw your screw in or hammer your nail in with it and then you're done. It's a place where you go and think about ideas, which is wildly fascinating to me. It's also recursive to me, because I can think about my thinking as I'm thinking about my thinking within this cognitive space, and it allows me to what does it allow me to do? Does it allow me to do anything differently? Yeah, it does. It does allow me to do things differently. It allows me to do things expeditiously. It allows me to see all of the various possibilities of a single thought and where it can lead to and what it can become. And I can select, hey, you know, I like that. I can also build with it. And this is a little segue here. I can build in this cognitive space an entire planet. An entire planet that I have had captured inside of my head for 7 years. For the last 7 years, I've had these stories on this planet. This planet is called Orbis. And in the last 2 years, I have been, because I want to see what AI can do, playing with it, asking, one of the first things I asked it was, hey, can I connect you to my calendar or my to-do list and help me, you know, get things done? No, it couldn't do that then. But there's possibilities now. We've got stuff like MCPs or agents or RAG or all these different little terminologies of technologies that have developed around generative artificial intelligence. These tools in the last couple of years have allowed me to, one, create a narrative of a corporation, Eckenrode Music and Optimi, and that narrative has generated an entirely different narrative about this planet Orbis. And so this corporation here today on Earth is writing this story about someplace 10,000 years in the future, maybe even in another cosmos. Perhaps I invented a science for this called interdimensional semiotics. Perhaps I didn't. Whatever. It doesn't matter. I don't care. It's a fun thing to say. So, with all of that, I have a vast array of tools that some really clever people around the planet have invented. A world map generator that allows me to have cities and villages and towns all over an entire world that I drew onto this map. And I have asked AI to help me define what's in each of these cities and villages and burgs. There's a large scope of things that I decided, like how many sovereign realms there are, or how many dragons there are on the planet. Dragons are important because, you know what? They call it Dungeons and Dragons, but if you come across a dragon, it's a big deal. But you're always in a dungeon, so why aren't you coming across more dragons if you're always in dungeons? I don't know. Maybe we're scared of dragons? Anyway, my planet, you're gonna come across a lot of dragons. I mean, when I play Dungeons and Dragons or take someone through Dungeons and Dragons or write stories about Dungeons and Dragons, I have dungeons and I have dragons all over the planet of Orbis. I also have templates. Yeah, that's an odd segue, right? Templates. I have templates Why would you mention templates? You were on a roll there, Nathan, with talking about Dungeons and Dragons and populating an entire planet. Now you're talking about templates. Templates. I have templates for what an epic looks like. How many adventures develop a narrative arc within that epic? How many chapters are within that adventure? How many scenes are within that chapter? What happens in that scene that builds on to the next scene, that builds on to the next scene, that builds up the chapter, that builds up the adventure, that builds up the entire narrative plot and subplots that these characters can go through? I have a history of 10,000 years that I need to fill. That's a lot of history. Think about this planet, the one we live on, how much history we have in 10,000 years. Think about how much history we have in 1,000 years. How much history we have in 100 years. There's a lot. There's a lot. Life is one of those things that moves quickly in all directions, in all dimensions. And to replicate an entire planet that has history, cause and effect, an entire causal domain, if you will, takes a lot of data. Takes a lot of data just to give a bare bones outline to it. When you get into the nitty gritty of this moment is now. Now this moment is now. Now this moment is now. The amount of data it takes to synthesize, to simulate an entire planet, an entire galaxy, an entire cosmos. It's beyond astronomical. It's beyond the scope of what we typically regard as technologically capable. We can fake it. We can fictionalize it. And our brains, when we listen to the story, when we watch the movie, when we hear the songs about it, we synthesize on our own. The audience, we are part of the creative process, because you can leave gaping holes in the story. You can leave vast unanswered questions, and the audience, especially now, will step into that space and come up with their own answers. You don't believe me? There's a term that has come about in the last 20 years called fan fiction. If you have a franchise out there, if your creative franchise is published, is in the space where mass media has adopted it, you know, something that happens in a galaxy far, far away. There are fan fiction theories that have been floating around for the last 30 years about what happens in between those movies or off screen when certain characters are no longer on the scene. This is a phenomenon, a creative phenomenon, which, you know, it reminds me now that we're onto it, this concept. So in the Danish play, William Shakespeare has all these characters, main characters, protagonists, antagonists, they carry the plot of this story. However, there are two characters who occur sporadically. They're minor characters, supporting characters. They have a few lines here and there that move the main story forward. However, in the 90s, these two characters were explored quite brilliantly. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead is the name of the movie. Two amazing actors played them. And you get their lines from the Shakespeare play sprinkled out as signposts along the way that these characters have to be there and deliver. However, what happens between those lines is certainly not something that the bard anticipated. And yet this became a rather well received, as far as I can tell. I was in New York at the time, and I was involved in filmmaking, and I heard about it from a fellow person who was in the film industry, and we went and saw it together, because that's what you do when you're in the film industry, and someone tells you, hey, there's this film you should see, you go with them to go see it. And at the time, if you didn't see it in the theater, then you probably weren't going to see it. So we went downtown and we saw it, and I walked out and I thought that was a really, really clever, really, really smart movie. I really thoroughly enjoyed it because the concept of what characters do off screen from a main story hadn't been shown to me before. It's the first example I know of this concept. So all of this is to say, it's to say something, I'm sure. I was going somewhere before I went off on this little tangent. Anyway, so if you have a cognitive space and you have established an outline, however large that cognitive space is, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. That's a pretty large cognitive space. It's a hem space. It has its own coordinates. It has its own trajectories. It has its own spin variables. You could plot it out in probably six variables in a matrix. And that defines that cognitive space. And cognitive spaces with help, with technology, with tools, allows you to explore that space more thoroughly, more systematically, not less creatively, but more so, because you can take a concept and build upon it, extrapolate from it, make it much larger than you initially thought it could be. And with that, I'm pretty excited to be 10 scenes into writing a novel about this space that I've been carrying around in my head for 7 years, taking up all my brain cells, and I've offloaded it. And I have created my own set of tools on top of these cognitive space tools that allow me to access various ideas and threads of ideas and spin them and weave them into narratives using my templates, using technology. I totally meant to say more about picking my pencils up and drawing more recently, but I think what I'm going to do is stop talking for now and let the last 5 minutes.